Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Podcast where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. I'm your host, E.L. King, and on this episode, we'll be discussing the iconic American independent slasher film Friday the 13th, directed by Sean S. Cunningham, which was released theatrically on May 9th, 1980 across the United States. It's a tale as old as time. A group of camp counselors trying to reopen a summer camp called Crystal Lake, which has a grim past, are stalked by a mysterious killer. And we all know that Camp Crystal Lake is fondly known as Camp Blood, and that this film would spawn several more camp horror films to come.
I'd had this dream.
I'm in a thunderstorm,
and it's raining really hard. It sounds like pebbles when it hits the ground. I try to block out the sound with my hands, only it doesn't work. It just keeps getting louder and louder. And then the rain turns to blood.
It's just a dream.
Ah! Are you crazy?
We ain't gonna stand for no weirdness out here.
Hello?
Help me!
Did you know that a young boy drowned here?
Help me!
His name was Jason, and today is his birthday.
Help me!
This place is cursed. You're doomed if you stay here.
Help me!
It's not funny anymore! Not funny at all!
Help me!
They're both dead!
And he's still there.
Friday, the 13th. You may only see it once, but that will be enough. Friday, the 13th.
Joining me by the campfire today are first-timers Chewy from the Exploring the Myths Behind the Legends podcast, Brian, our good buddy, formerly of the Dead in Santa Carla podcast, and once again, Death himself, Twitch partner and horror content creator, Games with Death. Welcome, everybody. Is everyone ready to chat horror with me today?
Very ready.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Chewy and Brian, you're new to the podcast, so why don't you tell everyone how you discovered your love of horror?
Oh, that's actually pretty easy because coincidentally, I discovered that I was a horror fan through a Jason movie, Friday the 13th Part 8, which is the one that everyone seems to hate the most.
Oh, Jason Takes Manhattan is like my favorite.
Yeah, mine too. And the reason for that is because that was the first one that I actually watched. And I was like 4 or 5 years old and I was terrified completely. I had no idea what was going on, but I actually had nightmares for a few weeks. I would dream that Jason was chasing me around the house. It was hilarious. And after that, I just became a huge Jason fan. So I guess I like being tortured or something. I don't know, subconsciously.
I love it. And you're not alone, neither you or, you know, because I love that friggin' movie too. I'm a Jason Takes Manhattan fan for sure.
A good time.
It is. It's a blast. I think my love of horror stems when I was really young as well. The first horror movie I ever remember seeing was The Fog, the original, and I've been a fan since. My favorite film of all time is Halloween. I guess I'm just a John Carpenter fan at my core, but yeah, that's I was probably 4 or 5, probably same age as you, Chewy, when I discovered my love of horror, and I've just been a fan ever since.
I need every one of you to tell me why you love Friday the 13th.
Ooh, classic. It's gritty. It's 80s. It's gory. I think that was something that hadn't been done before. And it also has that really iconic title, like Friday the 13th, right? Which sort of has something to do with the movie, just that it takes place on Friday the 13th, but it's this nice popular folklore kind of film that is really cool, and it's just legendary. It's one of the classics. If you don't know it, you really don't know horror, I think.
Yeah, there's a great backstory when it comes to Friday the 13th and how it came to be, which we'll talk about. Chewy, what about you?
I agree with Death. I think it's a landmark movie in horror history. I do think I can't seem to remember any other movie that was as well. It's not really violent, but if you think about a movie like Halloween, for example, the deaths in that movie aren't really that much graphic. You don't see a lot of blood or a lot of action, but in this movie, it's a little bit more. They show more, and I think that's because Tom Savini was involved in this, if I'm not mistaken. So.
Yeah, turning the slasher tide for mm-hmm. the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of raised the bar a little bit. So after that, of course, that's when the whole censorship thing got a little bit more, it clamped down on this kind of thing. So it kind of raised the bar, but at the same time, it kind of limited what other people could do at the same time. So, but as far as the story, I mean, it's pretty interesting. I mean, people would think that it's the typical slasher, and it kind of is in a way, but of course, that's the difference of who the killer is.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. It's legendary, as Death said. It's a great example of passionate poor person filmmaking. These guys did this with no hardly any budget, and you get super fun characters you can follow around. I'm a big fan of characters in movies. You get a ridiculously young, handsome Kevin Bacon, and that's always plus. But yeah, this is just great, passionate, you know, filmmaking with no money at its core, and it's a blast to watch.
So Crystal Lake's history of murder doesn't deter counselors from setting up a summer camp in the woodsy area. Thank you so much. What's his fuck, Christy? That's all I know. So superstitious locals warn against it, but the fresh-faced young people, including Jack, played by Kevin Bacon, Alice, played by Adrian King, Bill, played by Harry Crosby, who's Bing Crosby's son, by the way, Marcy, played by Janine Taylor, and Ned, played by Mark Nelson. They pay very little heed to what the people in town are saying, specifically that kooky old man that I think tries to run after Annie at the beginning of the film.
You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you?
God damn it, Ralph, get out of here. Go on, get. Leave people alone.
You'll never come back again.
Oh, shut up, Ralph.
It's got a death curse.
He's a real prophet of doom, ain't he?
But the film also stars Betsy Palmer, who plays Mrs. Voorhees, who initially didn't want to take the role, but she needed the $10,000 to buy a new car. So that sealed it for her. So they soon find themselves stalked by a brutal killer as they're slashed, shot, and stabbed, and the counselors struggle to stay alive against a merciless murderer. So Friday the 13th is an American independent slasher film. Cunningham had actually previously worked with Wes Craven on the film The Last House on the Left in 1972. And prompted by the success of John Carpenter's Halloween in 1978 and inspired by Mario Bava and Hitchcock, Cunningham wanted Friday the 13th to be shocking, visually stunning, and a film that makes you jump out of your seat. Wanting to distance himself from The Last House on the Left, Cunningham wanted Friday the 13th to be more of a roller coaster ride. And I think it's definitely that in some respects. The film was intended to be a real scary movie and at the same time make the audience laugh. So do we feel like Sean Cunningham reached the goal that he set out for? Like, yes, Friday the 13th is super successful. Do you feel like it's a real scary movie and that it's one that you can laugh along with?
I think so. It's definitely it's a more fun watch than Last House. that's kind of a.
Well, really... I think we're talking in comparison to Halloween.
Oh, okay. In comparison. Yeah. It's a more fun movie than Halloween. I think, Halloween's a better film, in my opinion, but it's got a more fun factor. It's definitely more gory also because there's no blood in Halloween at all. It's like really whatsoever.
That is true. I think story-wise, I like Halloween a little bit better, but this one is, in some respects, a lot more fun.
I think it does, because just for the fact of that it's teenagers camping, and of course, it's actors that are older, but as far as the characters go, they're supposed to be teenagers, like maybe right out of high school. So it's kind of capturing that whole innocence lost type of thing, like last summer before life starts, so to speak. So it's them getting a job as camp counselors, but at the same time, they're having fun on their own. I mean, you see them playing pranks on each other and indulging in things that, you know, teenagers would normally do. Maybe sometimes adults as well. extracurricular substances, you know, of course. But yeah, I feel like it's more of a... It's not coming of age, but it's more of that time period in a person's life, I guess, where they're right about to jump into another stage in their life. So I think it does capture that in a sense.
Yeah. And I think for me, I could see the high school thing, but I could also kind of see them as just like, this is the summer job they took in between college semesters, maybe. I get that very early college sense, maybe 19, 20 years old. So Cunningham had actually put an advertisement out to sell the film in Variety in early 1979, which is funny because Variety really cut this film a new one in their review. But while Miller was still drafting the screenplay after casting the film in New York City, filming took place in New Jersey in the summer of 1979 on an independent budget at the Boy Scout Camp Bebo Bosco. A bidding war ensued over the finished film, ending with Paramount Pictures acquiring the film for domestic distribution, while Warner Brothers secured international distribution rights. The opening scene establishes Camp Crystal Lake's history of bloodshed with the murders of two fornicating counselors in 1958.
Somebody will see. Marianne kiss as good as I do?
How would I know?
Oh, you. You said we were special.
I meant everything.
Somebody there.
We weren't doing anything. We were just messing around.
Absolutely love the way that the opening builds tension, especially with that fantastic score. And then we find ourselves in the future on June 13th, 1979. So perhaps the most noticeable influence from Carpenter, who borrowed it from 1974's Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark, is the eerie perspective shots of each kill from the killer's point of view, thanks to the director of photography, Barry Abrams, with Tom Savini as the special effects makeup artist. And, of course, the cold open of the film. The original screenplay was tentatively titled A Long Night at Camp Blood, which lives on in the way that the teens reference the camp's history throughout the film series. I think it was part four where they, and part two where they said Camp Blood many times. So we should definitely take a moment to also call out the incredibly piercing and anxiety-inducing score by composer Harry Mann Fredini, who scored hundreds of films and would go on to create the music for most of the Friday the 13th film series. And he also borrowed a little bit from Hitchcock's Psycho with that score. You can hear some similarities. Oh, not to mention... meant to resemble Jason's voice saying, kill, 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 mom, 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 in Mrs. Voorhees' mind, which of course presents us the brilliant line, kill her, mommy, kill her, during the film's climax. So this is going to be a real bloody and meaty episode, so buckle up. Let's step into a segment we like to call Creep Me Out, where we explore the true events and lore that inspired the film. Now, we know that this film was meant to be realistically a ripoff of Halloween, and Sean Cunningham has admitted as much. Friday the 13th was just a cash grab. It doesn't actually relate to anything, except that there are legends. There are legends about Friday the 13th. There are legends about summer camp. So let's talk about some summer camp urban legends. So in an article by Meredith Vitale called The Cropsey Maniac, Meredith says, the story of the Cropsey Maniac exemplifies a legend used at summer camp to reinforce what is expected of the group. The legend is local to New York, and often New York City children are sent to camp during the summer as a way to experience nature away from modern city life. So that is something that Annie says at the beginning of the film. It's mostly going to be like inner city kids, you know, going to camp for the summer. Campfire stories and legends allow children to experiment with otherwise terrifying ideas or scenarios in a safe setting. A perennial story in New York summer camps is the Cropsey Maniac legend, a story about a respected member of the community who becomes insane with the desire to avenge an accidental death of his family and stalks the outskirts of the camp property. While there are different details specific to the several variants of the legend, the plot of the Cropsey legend remains relatively consistent. In the many different variations that have been collected, George Cropsey is always a respected adult male who goes insane after the accidental deaths of his family members and becomes the Cropsey maniac. Most variants involve the accidental death of his children, and often an irresponsible camper starting a fire is the indirect cause of their deaths. After disappearing for several weeks, the Cropsey maniac returns to take his revenge on the camp. Campers begin showing up murdered, and Cropsey leaves behind messages like burning Cropsey onto the arm of one of his victims and starting small fires in the woods to make campers aware of his presence. Camp counselors protect their campers by blocking the cabin door and sleeping with hatchets. One counselor is able to injure Cropsey with his hatchet, but he escapes nevertheless. The authorities attempt to capture Cropsey, but their efforts are futile. Despite being shot multiple times, Cropsey escapes the police siege, and his body is never found. There's no evidence for Cropsey's death, and strange voices and low, terrifying laughter is still heard from the woods by campers in the years following the Cropsey's last appearance. The character of the Cropsey maniac is a formerly respected member of the community who goes insane and retreats to the woods. The background story shows campers that an average person who would usually be trusted in a city setting may not be trusted in unfamiliar places. This shows the uncertainty of what might lurk in nature and serves as a warning away from the unknown. The Cropsymaniac also has the common motif of a mentally insane villain. The accidental death of Cropsy's children caused by a fire set by campers also serves as a warning. It reminds campers that accidental death does happen and shows the danger of irresponsibility. When Cropsy starts to take his revenge, the body of a camper is found dead. This indicates that no one saw the murder take place because the camper was alone when they were killed. In Friday the 13th, Mrs. Voorhees dispatches each of the counselors one by one. We see the perspective of them getting killed through her eyes, but the bodies aren't found or discovered until the big reveal at the end, which is another inspiration from Halloween. This implies the danger of wandering camp alone and encourages campers to stick together in groups. After the murder, the police search for Cropsy but are unable to find him. A counselor bravely protects their campers when Cropsy enters the cabin at night, but Cropsy is still able to escape. The failure of the authorities juxtapose the success of the counselor is another message to the campers. It shows the people who protect the city are no match for the Cropsymaniac who knows the lay of the woods. Only the brave counselor in efforts to protect their campers can effectively slow Cropsy down, and even then the delay is only temporary. In 1981, The Burning came out, and that came after Friday the 13th, of course, and that can be considered another variant of the Cropsy legend. So before the release of the film, the Cropsy legend was largely unknown outside of the areas local to New York, as the legend had always been orally transmitted at various camps. The film takes place at fictional Camp Blackfoot and features the camp caretaker named Cropsy, who is horribly burned by campers during a practical joke gone wrong. So what's interesting is that I think that this film actually pulls a lot of inspiration from Friday the 13th. And while I don't know exactly what Sean Cunningham might have researched, this legend definitely echoes a lot of the storyline sentiment and Mrs. Voorhees' motivations for why these murders are happening, right? Interestingly enough, before Scream called it out, and while Halloween has a very sex equals death premise, this also, more pointedly, has a sex equals death premise. And that's Friday the 13th specifically, because the whole idea is you were having sex, you weren't watching my kid drowned, now I'm going to take revenge, sex equals death. So let's get into some analysis of the themes, because there's a couple. We're going to discuss the themes of teen sexuality and the female villain in Friday the 13th. According to some analysis on the film, specifically when it comes to teen sexuality, film scholars view Friday the 13th as symptomatic of its era, particularly the Reagan era of America, and part of a trajectory of films such as The Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 1974 and Race with the Devil in 1975, which exemplify a particular apocalyptic vision moving from disclosing family contradictions to self-indulgent nihilism. The film's recurring use of point-of-view shots from the killer's perspective have been noted by scholars such as Philip DeMare as inherently voyeuristic. DeMare regards the film as a cautionary tale that succeeds in warning against the sexual impropriety, even as it fetishizes violent transgression.
That's pretty deep.
Yeah, that is literally exactly what I was getting ready to say.
I mean, that's what happens when you analyze films.
That's like the answer on the exam for Friday the 13th right there. So, but I think that it is like the Reagan era stuff. I don't know if any of you guys were alive during the Reagan era. I sort of was. And so like the whole home life kind of deal with that era is just like, I think the reason why that movie would resonate so much in the 1980s is because there was this picturesque view of how, you know, your world was supposed to be. And this killer at this summer camp, like I actually went to summer camp during this period, and then like to actually watch like Friday the 13th and then like be terrified of it and stuff, it's like a very real visceral experience. But it's also like, I think that it's just this pervading, you know, this pervading way that you were supposed to be that kind of permeated a lot of things. Like you see, like, you know, there's almost like a conservatism that's around, especially in the townsfolks and stuff like this. And here are these new teenagers who are trying to make their own way, but it's like they violate the rules before, and then they get killed by this like lady that looks a lot like Nancy Reagan. I'm not going to like lie, but like, you know, she really does. So it's deep in that kind of sense. And it's like having actually lived through that era and thinking back to it, it's like you watch it with like an affection, but you also watch it with like a lot of terror. And I think that that's why it connects with me a lot too.
Well, when they mentioned the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I can kind of see a correlation between the teens in this film and like that hippie sort of vibe of the teens or the young adults in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So I can kind of see a connection there. And then the sexual impropriety thing definitely does come up, and it's then becomes a thread throughout the film series, I think.
100%.
Yeah, it goes back to the whole, I mean, I don't know if everyone needs to be virgin. I don't know if everyone needs to be virgins to not get murdered, but I'm pretty sure that Mrs. Voorhees says something about they were too busy having sex to watch my son. So
don't the virgins just get murdered last, but everybody still gets murdered anyways?
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, except that Alice represents the pure virginal character, even though we're all pretty sure that she's had sex before.
Yeah, I think it's implied, I think, that she and Christy had something going on before they were, or right before they were starting working at the camp together.
Yeah, she definitely fucked someone. We just don't know who.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how old this guy is. He looks to me like he's in his late 30s, early 40s, maybe. And she seems like she's in her
40 years old. There's no way.
No, not her. The guy. The guy is like 40 years old, I think. The
no,
like,
I don't think. No, he's not 40.
Camp counselor? The guy who's running the place?
The one running is.
Yeah, no.
No. Okay, no, that guy's way. Early 30s most.
I'm not even 40.
Really?
Yeah, no, there's no way. That dude is like late 20s, early 30s for the 1980s.
He looks like a total dad to me. I'm sorry.
It's just because he dresses like your grandparents now, so that's why he feels so old.
I'm sorry, man. I mean, I'm not a spring chicken anymore myself. I mean, I'm about to be 38 here, but yeah, so I mean, I had that impression that he was older, so but at any rate, yeah. I mean, yeah,
me and Chewie are the same age. He's like, Christy looks like a fucking 40-year-old. I hadn't really thought about that before. I know that, I mean, quite a few people die after having sex in the film. At least Kevin Bacon does. Kevin and like, Bacon and his girlfriend.
There's only, like two people. I mean, because that's it, and that's
well,
it.
Well, I think also a lot of people die after the strip Monopoly.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's just like sexuality.
Yeah, I
in
guess
general.
Sexual. Yeah, just anything sexual related in the sense that, yeah.
Brenda Jones. So like Brenda, when Brenda's getting hunted down, Brenda is like wearing a very like a long granny nightdress, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, yeah, she
and a raincoat. So I feel like Brenda represents the virginal character more than anybody else.
I think
just
so.
Just in that outfit.
Mm-hmm. Just in that outfit, absolutely. But she was playing the strip Monopoly.
Everybody was playing strip Monopoly, yeah, and that yeah. You didn't know that when you pass go and too. Collect $200, you're also signing your death. This is what happens at banks. In talking about the gender of the villain. So the film has spurred critical discussion in regard to its villain being female, a plot point examined at length by film scholar Carol J. Clover in her book Men, Women, and Chainsaws. They talk about this book a lot when I read a film analysis. So congratulations, Carol Clover. So Clover notes the revelation of Pamela Voorhees as the killer as the most dramatic case of pulling out the gender rug in horror film history, commenting on the first-person point of view shots from the killer. Clover writes, "We, the audience, stalk and kill a number of teenagers over the course of an hour of movie time without even knowing who we are. We are invited by conventional expectation and by glimpses of our own bodily parts, a heavily booted foot, roughly gloved hand, to suppose that we are male, but we are revealed at the film's end as a woman." On the killer's identity, DeMare has noted, because Cunningham avoids revealing anything about the killer beyond the fact that the figure is dressed in men's gloves and boots, the audience assumes the Slayer is a man. I mean, it's really a deception. So he really is sustaining the deception of the killer's age, social status, and gender deep into the film. So the use of the cinematic process of abstraction allows the film to linger over the ambiguous nature of evil until the climactic last act, which it is like a big fun last act, I think.
I agree. I think the last act is one of the strongest things.
Yeah. Also, she's like defying as far as gender goes and stuff. This is a strong woman for being in her 50s, 60s or something like that at this point. Like, you're like, how did you nail that guy to that door with the three arrows and then still make him stay up there and then still have the strength to kill him and stuff? And it's like,
it kind of comments on female vitality in that sense, I think, Death, from what you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a great villain in a lot of ways. Like, you really don't expect it, but yeah.
I think for one, it's you mentioned something about the dual nature of evil or something like that. So I think the fact that it turns out to be a woman, it just shows that anyone is capable of doing these things, whether or not. I mean, you can make a case to whether or not she had a justification in some form or another. I mean, she deems the camp counselor is responsible for the death of her son. So to a point, it's understandable. It's relatable that somebody that loses a loved one may have some sort of grief or anger towards who they think is responsible. But yeah, I mean, I do agree that she is definitely an icon for female strength and female endurance, because like Death mentioned right now, she pulls out some pretty unique feats of strength. I mean, the guy is literally pinned to a wall and she throws a body into a window, which I'm assuming it's not. I mean, I can barely pick up like 100 pounds and much less throw it. So it speaks to the fact that, yeah, I mean, it's definitely somebody that is very strong, even if her strength is misguided, so to speak.
So like, here's my question though. Is she actually feminine? Like, is she feminine in the sense that like she's okay, like she's obviously very strong, right? Which is a masculine quality. And so you're able to keep up that deception because you're like, who is able to do this except for a man that could do it? And then also like the fact that she's anti-sex, which is almost an anti-natal approach, right? Right? Like this is someone who is like, you let my son die. And therefore, you're all responsible. And she's, you know, obviously like targeting just people who are having sex, which is really funny in a way, because it's like, are you for children or not against, not for them, right? Like, wouldn't someone, or is she for her own procreation and stuff? So it's this competition.
I don't know.
it's a weird, like, I haven't been able to like understand that dichotomy. It's like, okay, you don't like sex and because you want to get the, because they were having sex, right? But it could have been anything. Like, it's very specifically sex that she does not like. So it's like, it could have been they were smoking weed. Why isn't everybody who's just smoking weed dying, right? Like I think there's more questions there.
So the backstory with it in terms of just like the plot is that when Mrs. Voorhees recounts to Alice like the backstory of, and kind of reveals who she is, she's talking about her son Jason, and he drowned in 1957, and she explains that his birthday's Friday the 13th, right? And that like she gets really aggressive talking about how the camp counselors were supposed to be watching them, but instead they snuck off to have sex. I just think that's where it comes from. But what I want to know is when we are looking at all these different deaths in the film, do you have any particular kill scenes that are your favorite? If it's just everyone says Kevin Bacon's kill, I'm going to be like, come on, y'all. But no, I won't judge you, I promise. I want to know what your favorite kill is. I want to know what some of your favorite scenes are, or like exchanges in terms of dialogue.
I like the first one, Annie's, because it kind of throws you a curveball. Normally, In most films, I would assume up to that point, the person that's deemed to be the protagonist is the one that comes up first. And we see her, and she looks like a nice little sweet girl, and she's very, what's the word I'm looking for? she looks very excited to be there and very energetic, and that contrasts with the energy from the townspeople, because they're like, everyone's like, ugh, whatever. So the build-up too, I mean, she gets the ride from the truck driver and she gets the backstory, and just from that conversation you get the sense that she's very carefree and she's just trying to live her life the way she wants to live it, not according to anybody else's opinions or anything like that.
She doesn't even flinch when that lady's like, Camp Blood?
Exactly. Yeah, so...
Like, I assume they all know the backstory, but it was just funny because she's just like, she sort of like shrugs her shoulders and is like, eh. And like, well, okay, can you give her a ride halfway there? It's like, well, I guess so. Everyone hop in my pickup truck. And then the kooky old guy is like, I don't know what he says. Like, you're gonna die. Or
yeah,
something
about you're doomed. Oh, no, that's later. I think that's...
He's got a death curse!
Yeah! Yeah, that's a good one.
That's like, to piggyback on that, that's a really good kill in many ways. One of them is, since she's one the first people that we're introduced to in, you know, in cinematic history, like almost the first person you're usually introduced to turns out to be like kind of the hero of the movie. So you develop a really strong attachment with her character right out the gate, and then bam, out of nowhere, she's just taken from you. So that's a really, really good kill.
And I don't know how frequently that happens, Brian, in horror cinema, but I'm wondering if we can then look at Wes Craven and be like, you borrowed the opening scene of Scream from Friday the 13th.
Oh, yeah.
And Friday the 13th borrowed a lot from you because you guys worked on each other's films together.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. There's a lot of borrowing going around in terms of, oh, that's really cool, I'm going to incorporate that into my film, which is great.
I like the whole dialogue with the cop there is hilarious. When he shows up. Yeah.
That dude, what a weird ass moment inside of the entire film. It's just kind of like, this, he comes in and you're like, this guy is like just a total jackass. And you're like, I think he's only in like the one scene, and he's just like, I'm looking for the crazy guy. And it's just like, what? Huh? What? But he's
crazies around here.
Yeah. he's just insane. And then, yeah. Oh God, yeah.
That whole exchange is ridiculous, man. It is a blast.
That was a weird moment. That was like one of those points in the movie where you're like, there's really no plot here. Like, none, there's just none. Really not. There's no plot. There's no character development. It's just kind of like, okay, we need a cop. Can we find a cop? Okay, this guy, and he can be a smart ass, and that's fine. So it works.
That guy didn't know how to ride that motorcycle at all. Like,
no, not at all.
He wrecked it at one point, I believe, if memory serves me correctly.
You got to go with Betsy getting her head chopped off. Like, I mean,
classic.
That's the best one. Like, you're like,
that's
number one.
Kill at the end.
Yeah.
She, with the machete.
She grabs the machete and she chops her freaking head off in one swipe. And you're just like, that's pretty good.
The look of shock on Betsy Palmer's face is like iconic.
Yeah.
Mistakes were made.
And supposedly, like, she's like really powerful and can overpower all these kind of things, but she has like literally like a 4-second lead time to the machete actually hitting her neck. But she's like, oh, I can't move. Yeah, I thought it was great. That's a great head getting chopped off.
I do know. So I like that one a lot as well. And I do know that Death particularly wants to talk about why Alice got in the canoe.
Yeah, I don't know why she got in the canoe.
I assume that the tires were slashed on all other cars, specifically Christie's, which I think was the only Jeep because everyone else got dropped off. So there was really no way out or to get somewhere else unless she jumped.
I just watched the movies that made us before I came on. And I believe that they said that they needed the studio said that they needed a Carrie ending. So they needed one of these endings where it was like, oh,
so
my God, like,
I'm
comes out of
gonna the... get. I'm going to get to that.
Oh, you're going to get to that. Okay.
I am going to get to that. Well, actually, I'll jump in with it right now. So the idea of Jason appearing at the end of the film was initially not used in the original script. So Miller's final draft, the film ended with Alice merely floating along the lake, like just, you know, serenely, and then it ends. But Jason's appearance was actually suggested by Tom Savini. He had stated that the whole reason for the cliffhanger at the end was that he had just seen Carrie in theaters because it came out in 1979. So he thought that it would be great to have that sort of chair jumper scare. And so he said, let's bring in Jason. And so when I think about that, I'm like, without that final edition of Friday the 13th, we might not have a franchise.
Well, probably not. Yeah.
You wouldn't have 12 movies without it, for sure.
I'm pretty sure that it was supposed intended to be like a one-off thing. I don't think they had any plans whatsoever to start a franchise, but I'm glad that they did.
But you know what? Jason lives. And somehow, from a crusty teenager coming out of the lake, he became a man. So
yeah, I love that he did. He aged quite a bit in the year.
Yeah, from the time that he murders poor Alice in the very beginning of part two. Sorry, spoiler alert, the 80s were a long time ago. But I don't think that much time has passed, and all of a sudden he's a full ass grown man.
I guess that's probably supposed to be a dream sequence, I guess. I don't know.
I think it was intended as a dream sequence, and then I think that's the assumption, is that it's a dream sequence, because then we jump to the hospital scene. Where she's like, oh my God, did you find the boy? Jason, he was there in the water. That is a good jump scare scene though. But I assume that the hospital scene and that those lines were added in later as well.
There's another eerie thing about like all of that is that there's never really any, there's like in the whole film, there's never really any like supernatural explanation given, you know, like you're not like, it's not like, oh, okay, this is like Satanism or something, or it's like, you know, some kind of like power that's alluded to. It's,
yeah, there's no Thorn trilogy, you know, as far as Jason's concerned.
Yeah, which is really weird. I think that review you mentioned is like the nihilism that's just in it, like the nothingness, right? Like it's almost even scarier, the fact that it's like you can't pin it on like demons or ghosts or something. It's just pure evil, like not evil. It's not even like a pure,
it's a mother's,
yeah,
love,
it's a human kind of thing. It's not even like a Halloween's pure evil. Like Michael Myers is like probably even like a little bit more comforting in a sense, because you know, you're like, oh, okay, he's just pure evil, you understand that. But it's like you have no idea where Jason, why he pops out of that lake at all.
Well, I think the rest of the thread for the franchise is revenge for the death of his mother, and the idea is that he was his body or spirit or whatever was looking on from the bottom of the lake. But I guess I then assume they never found his body. I can't recall if they said that specifically.
I'll be honest, I got,
or if she did in her monologue.
I started watching part two and I stopped completely. I just was like, this movie's so bad, I can't do it. And then,
part two gets better after the opening.
Part two was hard.
The ending, part two has like one of my favorite final acts.
Mm-hmm. I love part two. I do. I love it.
Yeah, you have to get past the opening, truth, honestly. Truth. It's much, yeah, better once you get into the thick of it. Yeah, I even enjoy the final chapter at times.
That's actually my favorite.
The final
one.
Chapter before the rest of, yeah, the films.
That's my favorite one, part four.
Well, I think Crispin Glover and the dance scene.
That's why it's my favorite one.
Really a classic moment in cinema.
But anyway, it's enough about part four. So, of course, very cleverly, the body count for this film is 13. Lucky number 13, or unlucky number 13. So as far as critical response goes, and talking a little bit more about the reception of the film, Friday the 13th opened theatrically, like we said, on May 9th, 1980 across the United States, and ultimately it expanded its release to 1,127 theaters, and it finished its domestic run with a profit of well over $39 million. So they sold a total of 14,778,700 admission tickets for the film, which I thought was just like a fun number.
I was just getting ready to say that's very specific.
Yes. So it was the 18th highest grossing film that year, facing competition from other high profile horror releases such as The Shining, Dressed to Kill, The Fog, and Prom Night. So of the 17 films distributed by Paramount in 1980, only Airplane returned more profits than Friday the 13th, which is pretty great for an independent budget. Before I get deeper, actually, I'll finish the critical response. Then I forgot to go further into the film trivia piece, so we'll jump back. But the critical response was actually divided, with some praising the film's cinematography, score, and performances, while numerous others ridiculed it for its depiction of graphic violence. So Linda Gross of the Los Angeles Times referred to the film as a silly, boring, youth-geared horror movie, though she praised the nervous musical score, the cinematography, and the performances in the film, but she deemed them to be natural and appealing. So she really liked the performances from Taylor, Bacon, Nelson, and Bartram. So Variety, however, deemed the film low budget in the worst sense, with no apparent talent or intelligence to offset its technical inadequacies. Friday the 13th has nothing to exploit but its title. So many critics compared the film unfavorably against John Carpenter's Halloween because of the similarities. So especially with the title, which is very catchy. So on Rotten Tomatoes, Friday the 13th holds an approval rating of 63% based on 56 reviews from approved critics. And the site's critics consensus reads, rather quaint by today's standards, Friday the 13th still has its share of bloody surprises and a 70s holdover aesthetic to slightly compel. It was nominated for Worst Picture at the first Golden Raspberry Awards, and Palmer was nominated for Worst Supporting Actress.
I gotta say, like, it's so fun to watch, to read critic reviews from like 20, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. because you end up like sitting there going, like, this person who like is supposedly supposed to know everything about what a good movie is supposed to be and what good art is supposed to be is just proven wrong after, you know, so many decades have gone by. It's so lovely to see that actually sometimes.
Yeah, like in some ways it's similar to The Thing because of the cult following, except that this had, it was a huge box office success. Yeah. So in that way, it's like, it's not like The Thing ruined, at all. They're both equally iconic.
I'm going to forget her name too, the one who has sex with Kevin Bacon. That's just, I guess I'll just call her that. It ruined her career as well because
Janine Taylor.
It ruined Janine Taylor's career too because she was part of her early stuff was that she was doing a bunch of New York film stuff and she wasn't big in the New York film scene, and then
a lot of them were stage actors
and then she ended up getting just blacklisted because she was in this horror movie that ended up being, you know, probably one of the best horror movies of all time, or is one of the best horror movies of all time, which is funny to see.
So yeah, what's everybody's like rating and review of Friday the 13th?
I'll go first. I think it's I give it a 4.5. Number one, like, it's there's not like a, like, okay, Halloween is like one of my like gold standards when it comes to like a 5. And I just, there's not like a character inside of it where you're just like, okay, this is like a Laurie, right? Like, I mean, you empathize with Laurie, you know what Laurie's going through. Like, you see, you want to know more about Laurie, you know, like, I mean, she's probably one of the greatest final girls ever.
There's more character development, even though they're about
the same length. Yeah. It's like you understand a little bit more about Laurie because she has a relationship with her father. She has a relationship with, with the stuff that's going on around her and stuff. So it's like, there's a history there. With this, it's kind of like, they're just kind of like throwaways, and it's also just kind of like, it is admittedly, like, they do admit it, this is a ripoff of what Halloween did, so it's kind of like there's a little bit more originality and it expands upon the genre, but I don't think it's it's legendary. I don't think it was like it's the second one, that's why I can't give it like a 5. It's not like something that is breaking,
it's not revolutionary, like,
yeah, it's not breaking into a new ground, but it's really, really improving upon that ground that's already there, and it's making it, you know, like, I mean, does it continue to have this kind of like gravitas when it comes to slasher horror flicks if you don't have a Friday the 13th, right? So, like, you know.
Yeah, and Victor Miller totally said he was just writing the popularity of Halloween.
Oh,
he wrote the script and they had this idea. So it's like, oh, we want to make a blockbuster horror movie? Let's fucking take Halloween and make it Friday the 13th. Although this did definitely establish summer camp horror films, I feel like.
Yeah.
In terms of that setting, which gotten a lot of those over the years.
100% agree.
I'm going to agree with that. It's a really well done film considering the limitations they had as far as budget and stuff like that. And the story, even though it is ripping off Halloween majorly, it kind of, I feel like a lot more movies, like you were mentioning, like the summer camp movies, made their scripts based off of this. So I'm not saying that it's influenced or that it's more influential than Halloween, because I agree with you guys saying that Halloween is a better movie. As far as it was made and the acting and the plot and the character development. But I do feel like you can see the legacy of this movie a little bit more. Like, it became campy. I mean, not just the series itself, but the other ones that were kind of doing the summer camp stuff. But you can see how they got their inspiration from this one. And I love the fact that the killer is a woman. It's just a really good spin, a good kind of twist, if you want to call it that. And I do feel like without this movie, there would have been a lot less good slasher films in the 80s, which is really my bread and butter. So, but yeah, I mean, the acting itself is it's adequate. I mean, these guys had theater experience, so I don't see any major fault in that. And yeah, I mean, that'll be my score, 4.5.
Well, I'm going to slide underneath you guys at a 4. I love the movie. It's not my favorite in the franchise. It's probably not even my second favorite. But the things that that keep it from being, you know, rated higher, I agree with Death. This is a ripoff movie. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a ripoff movie that's done pretty well. Victor was literally instructed by Sean, hey, let's rip off Halloween. So you're not gonna, you know, it's gonna lose some points for that. But some of the things that it did so very well, I mean, the score is fantastic. I love the POV shots in this movie. It places you right there in the film. And then obviously the big reveal, because this movie at its core is a slasher whodunit. And then the big reveal at the end that it's a woman doing all these killings is like almost like the cherry on top of the sundae or whatever. It's a super fun film filled with just great throwaway characters that you can latch onto for a split second and then get to watch them get dispatched in super unique ways with wonderful effects by one of the greatest ever to work in the industry, Tom Savini. I'll slide in just a little under you guys at 4.
I honestly think that I am teetering somewhere between a 3.5 to a 4. It is iconic. It's not a bad film by any means, but there's a lot of things about it just from a technical perspective that I'm like, it's not like it's the greatest film ever made. And I am such a fan of Halloween. All those kind of ripoff moments, I'm just like, yeah, I mean, but there are things that it did for horror films that I think are great. So I'm always going to love it, but I still think if I'm taking a look at all of the aspects of the film from a little farther away, it's probably like a 3.5 to a 4.
Just to add to your point, it like started to make the pantheon, right? Like it's the second one, and it's like, that's great. It got the ball rolling. I just want to throw out the word pantheon to make myself sound smart. So thank you.
I love that.
Well, yeah. I mean, what 1984 is, I mean, you got your Trinity, your Holy Trinity, right? Like Michael Myers, Jason and Freddy Krueger, right? Those guys. Yeah.
I will say, if I hearken back to like when we're talking about certain scenes in the film, that I really love the twist of it being Mrs. Voorhees as the killer. And in part because when she shows up and she says, I'm Mrs. Voorhees, I'm a friend of the Christies. And Alice just immediately, because she's a woman, there's this false sense of security. And she goes in and hugs her.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, that about wraps it up. So thank you all for coming on Slayaway to talk about Friday the 13th with me.
No, thank you so much for having me. All of us. This was a blast. It was wonderful meeting all of you and talking horror with you.
Yeah,
likewise.
You too.
Definitely looking forward to maybe doing this again in the future.
Death's already been here three times.
I will talk horror anytime with anybody. It is my jam.